Good afternoon and welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show. My name is Ed Chung. I'm the Vice President for Criminal Justice Reform at the Center for American Progress. I'll be your guest host for the day, and we've got a great show lined up for you. So if you want to be part of the conversation, feel free to call in at 1-888-6-LESLIE. That's 1-888-653-7543. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Leslie Marshall. And also you can follow me as well at Ed Chung Tweets. That's E-D-C-H-U-N-G Tweets. Lots of big news happening this week. It seems like lots of big news happens every week in this administration. The biggest development, of course, is that yesterday Senate Republicans finally released their health care bill. And guess what? It's horrible. Republican senators basically took a very bad House bill, which, if you remember, would insure 23 million fewer people than the Affordable Care Act. And then they asked themselves, how can we make this even worse? So in addition to getting rid of the individual and employer mandates, they cut Medicaid drastically. They took away tax credits to offset costs for people buying insurance. It's like they took President Trump's comments that the House version was mean, 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 and then took that as a challenge to see if they can make it even worse. And guess what? They actually succeeded. If you want to learn more about this, Leslie had a great show yesterday with my colleague, Mara Kelson. You could get to that show at lesliemarshall.com and just click on the podcast tab there. And it's a great listen, so I encourage everyone to do that. But today we're going to be talking about another issue that's very timely, which is gun violence and gun violence prevention. It seems like a lifetime ago already, but it was just last week when a group of Republican legislators, members of Congress, and their staff were practicing for the annual congressional baseball game when a gunman opened fire on them in broad daylight in the morning hours at a public park in Northern Virginia here. Several people were injured, including Rep. Steve Scalise and two Capitol police officers, Crystal Griner and David Bailey, and we hope that all of those who were injured are on their way to a speedy recovery. But the debate over guns and gun violence in our society continues to rage on. You know, with me to discuss the issues today is Nico Bocour. She is the State Legislative Manager for Americans for Responsible Solutions. Welcome, Nico.
Thank you.
And joining Nico is Stasha Rhodes, Director of Advocacy for Guns and Crime Policy here at the Center for American Progress. Good to have you both here.
Thanks for having us.
So it seems like whenever we have one of these horrific events, like the shooting at the congressional baseball practice, that now the country gets motivated and becomes gun violence prevention is a topic of conversation. But it's something that also affects people's lives all around the country. And so, you know, we know that crime is down and violent crime is down, but there is that connection between violent crime and gun violence. So give us kind of an overview. What is the prevalence of gun violence today? Stasha, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. So the GOP baseball shooting is the 154th mass shooting this year. Sadly, gun violence is now as American as baseball. The U.S. murder rate is 25 times higher than any other developed nation. Frankly, gun violence is a public health crisis at this point. We lose 33,000 people a year by guns, and that's nearly 90 people a day. In fact, the morning of the baseball shooting, I was getting dressed to attend an event in honor of the victims that were killed in Orlando, Florida at the Pulse nightclub 1 year ago, and the 9 African Americans that were killed 2 years ago in Charleston, South Carolina. You know, these shootings are happening far too often, and we are losing far too many lives to gun violence.
Yeah, and so, Nico, you do a lot of work in states and in localities around the country. And so what are communities saying to you? What are what's the effect of this in communities all across the country?
Yeah, I think the effect is really serious and really severe, and it's harming our communities and families. We have to understand, I think, the problem, as Stasha said. We're losing 33,000 Americans every year. This is a very serious crisis in our country. And then to be able to address that problem, we have to basically look at what opportunities there are. We focus, or I focus specifically, on what types of policies will help and reduce gun violence. And we work with leaders on the local level in states to try to have the greatest impact we can in their communities.
So, again, these are some horrific incidents that capture the public's attention, and the movement to reduce and prevent gun violence prevention seems to take root, and then sometimes it fades off from the public's view. What is the reason that we can't sustain some of that momentum, and what are why is this such a continuing problem in the United States?
You know, Ed, there are a number of reasons, both why we can't sustain it and why we haven't been able to make serious headway within the past 10 or 15 years. It's the NRA is a very influential gun lobby in America, and they have created this narrative that if you support common sense gun laws, then you're anti-Second Amendment, and that's totally not true. You can respect the Second Amendment and take action to keep guns out of the wrong hands. In fact, many gun owners support common sense gun measures like background checks or ensuring that domestic abusers can't own guns. The NRA leadership has taken its message further and further right, and they have become more and more extreme. Simply put, they believe in guns anywhere and everywhere. And honestly, even Justice Scalia has said in the Heller decision that the Second Amendment isn't an unlimited right, that you can't keep and carry weapons, any weapon whatsoever, in any manner whatsoever.
And the Heller decision was the one that basically affirmed a person's right to carry, or at least in their home, for protection purposes, weapons. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's right. And so, like, they have taken their message, their narrative, and done a really good job at making it widespread and become more and more extreme. And so one of the things that they often say, and I think right now we're in a very ironic space for them, is that the way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And we've just seen recently with the Philando Castile case that he was a good guy who had a gun legally, but was murdered by the police, and nothing from the NRA.
Yeah, and so is that Philando Castile, for those of you who don't know, he was a black man who was killed by in a traffic encounter with a police officer. He was legally carrying a firearm, and video from the incident shows, or you could hear, that he tells the officer that he's carrying. Usually in situations like that, you would see people who are pro-gun rights to come to the person's defense and say that this was egregious. And so, but that's not happening now.
Yeah, I think that what happens is that this just highlights that the NRA leadership has become more and more extreme. And so it seems that it's not about the Second Amendment anymore for the NRA. There was a time when the NRA supported common sense gun laws and would have stood up for something like this. But now, in this day and age, in this very toxic political environment that we live in, the NRA is a part of maintaining this narrative. And somehow, black men with guns don't fit into that narrative.
And Nico, in your work in states, are you running up against kind of this powerhouse lobby? Is it also in Congress, but also in states and localities as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We are definitely seeing the gun lobby in states, and they are very powerful. They're certainly very enthusiastic. But we're also seeing a lot of success in pushing back against their agenda. As Stasha said, they have gotten so extreme. People do not support the kinds of policies that they want to enact. And we're seeing that legislatures, even traditionally more conservative, gun-friendly legislatures, are just not interested in pursuing these really extreme agendas. For example, in Florida this year, following the shooting at Fort Lauderdale Airport, the gun lobby sought to expand the public places where guns could be carried, including in airports. And local and national groups pushed back. Common sense prevailed, and the gun lobby was unsuccessful in that effort.
And I think right after the congressional baseball shooting, too, we heard some calls from members of Congress to allow members of Congress to carry weapons where or carry firearms wherever they are as well. One other thing that I've heard and you know to ask you all on or about is that the number of firearms that have been sold since Trump has been elected has actually decreased significantly as compared to what is in the previous administration. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, so I don't actually know the numbers on that, but I think the overall mood would probably support that, right? I mean, we are seeing that when the gun lobby can push the narrative that their guns are going to be taken away by folks who are in positions of power, then they're able to sell more guns and really scare folks. And right now we're seeing people pushing back against that in states, and I think on the national level that will come as well.
Great. So we're going to pause this discussion right now, and we're going to come back right after the break. For those of you who are on the phone, please hold, and we'll get back to your calls. This has been The Leslie Marshall Show, and I'm Ed Chung. Welcome back to The Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your guest host today, Ed Chung, and we're talking gun violence prevention with Stasha Rhodes from the Center for American Progress and Nico Bocour from Americans for Responsible Solutions. So at the Center for American Progress, we recently released a report on how the federal government can help with reducing violence. And one of the things that was in the report was that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms were very under-equipped in inspecting gun dealers. And so that was incredibly striking to me. It seemed like in a year, it was only like 6% of gun dealers were inspected by the ATF. But Nico, what other kinds of steps can governments or can society take in order to help reduce gun violence?
I think keeping guns out of dangerous hands is the area where we look to focus in a lot. Obviously, supporting background checks and closing the background checks loopholes in states as well as on the federal level. And making sure that domestic abusers don't have access to guns is a really important area. The nexus between domestic violence and firearms is incredibly lethal. And we are working in states and seeing a lot of success in 5 states in the past year. We've seen laws enacted to help keep guns out of the hands of abusers. And these aren't just states that are traditionally supportive of strong gun laws. We're talking about Republican governors in Maryland and New Jersey, and states like North Dakota, Tennessee, and Utah passing these kinds of bills.
And we have a call on line 3, Ismail. Ismail, are you there? This is the Leslie Marshall Show.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call on the show, and then greeting to all you guests. You know, I just have a couple of ideas. I really think the declaring all guns as a public hazard would be a good idea to start. We also need to take a page from the tobacco industry the same way we approach the tobacco cigarettes. We should approach guns. And the last thing I wanted to say is that having each gun insured, it will help in terms of the background check and making sure the guns are at the right place and making sure that people use them responsibly. Yeah, and because this is becoming a health crisis, and we have to vote attorney generals in and basically approach it the same way we approach the tobacco companies.
Yeah, thanks, Ismail. That's a great question. On the point about the connection between the how to combat the gun industry versus the tobacco industry, Stasha, you have experience in this.
Yeah, I think he makes a good point that it's absolutely a public health crisis similar to the tobacco world. And, you know, the gun violence prevention space is moving in the same direction of success that the tobacco control advocates have seen over the past 50 years because they were able to sort of utilize the groundswell of support that Americans felt. And that same support is still here for gun violence prevention. And so the gun violence prevention space is doing a great job at ensuring that we're able to show policymakers that there's support on the ground, that we're able to mobilize advocates to say enough is enough. And that's exactly how the tobacco world was able to make a difference.
Yeah, we have another call. Reggie on line 1. Reggie, you're on the Leslie Marshall Show.
Happy Friday to you both. I would just like to know, do you think that the gun violence and rhetoric from AM conservative hate talk radio to coincide with each other or not? Do they have anything to do with each other or not? And if so, how do we put an end or stop to once and for all?
Yeah, so the connection between the rhetoric on the far right, and I think you mentioned talk radio, but the connection between that and kind of the gun pro-gun movement. So any connections that you can see?
Yeah, I think what happens is leadership in the NRA really stoke this extreme narrative that any sort of common sense gun laws is anti-Second Amendment, and that really works up a base. I think that that's the wrong direction. It's obvious that common sense gun laws are important. There are many gun owners that support common sense gun laws, and I think the more we highlight that fact, the better we are.
So kind of to wrap this segment up, I wanted to connect here what's going on with the gun violence prevention movement, as well as just a general activist society that we've seen, especially under this administration, and how much energy that you're seeing out there. And so, Nico, in your work in localities, is there the same movement and intensity in the gun violence prevention side? And how can we harness some of that energy to push and have sensible reforms?
I definitely do think that there is a lot of broad support and energy on our side of this issue in states, but I do think we need to continue to work and reach out and bring together the stakeholders on this issue, right? If we are talking about whether or not firearms should be on college campuses or in dorms, we're talking about a lot of different groups that are going to be impacted by that. On the local level, we have to make sure those folks are speaking out. So the gun violence prevention community, especially with our state work, we're really reaching out to all the folks to let them know that they are real stakeholders in this issue and making sure we're helping to elevate their voice.
Stasha, I'm going to give you the last word, actually.
Yeah, I just think that it's important for advocates on the ground, progressive advocates, to understand that you need to stay active in your local and state governments, because this is a public health crisis that demands action at every level. And so utilize that energy to help us stop and or at least reduce gun violence.
Well, we really appreciate you being here for this discussion, this incredibly timely discussion that affects way too many people in this country. Nico Bocour from Americans for Responsible Solutions, Stasha Rhodes from the Center for American Progress, thanks for being here. We'll be back right after this break. You're listening to The Leslie Marshall Show. And welcome back to The Leslie Marshall Show. I'm Ed Chung from the Center for American Progress, sitting in for Leslie today. For those of you who want to join in on the conversation, the number here is 1-888-6-LESLIE. That's 1-888-653-7543. So one thing that didn't get much attention earlier this week was that the Department of Justice held a conference right outside D.C. here on how the federal government should address violent crime in cities across America. And they announced this plan to work with a number of cities to help reduce violence in their communities. But one of the most concerning aspects of what the Justice Department is trying to do is blatantly revive the war on drugs from the 1980s and 1990s. And with me today to discuss the crime or the intersection between crime, drugs, and what our society should do with these issues is David Kennedy, who is the director of the National Network for Safe Communities at John Jay College in New York City. Welcome to the show, David. And also joining us is Michael Collins, deputy director of the Drug Policy Alliance here in D.C. Good to have you, Michael.
Hey, how you doing? Good to be here.
And David, are you on with us?
I am.
Great. Thanks for being here. And David, you have been studying this particular issue for a number of years, and I know the field has advanced significantly since the 1990s, but we seem to be in a time that we're kind of reverting back to what was popular and in vogue about 20 years ago. You know, what do we know now about this whole intersection between drugs and crime and violence that we didn't know back then?
Well, we know a lot. And you led off with exactly the right highlight, which is the DOJ's eagerness to return to what really looks like the war on drugs and a position that says we should punish as much and as hard as we can. And it worked so well during the crack epidemic, I don't know why we wouldn't do it again. and, So we know a lot of things, and the most important thing we know is that we as a nation have never made any headway on drug epidemics through heavy-duty law enforcement. It doesn't matter how many drug dealers you lock up or how long you lock them up for, they get replaced. And we've had no success in using any kind of enforcement at the source level. We haven't done anything about the cartels or those networks. Enforcement can't keep drugs out of the country. Once they're in the country, we don't have any luck at using enforcement to keep them out of our cities. And we've never been able to use enforcement to get rid of the gangs and networks that distribute them at the street level. And generations of drug enforcement have brought us mass incarceration and more available and pure narcotics. So like I say, I don't know why we wouldn't try it again.
So what are the types of strategies now, though, that you're implementing that seem to have an effect that does not rely only on enforcement, but then goes beyond that and kind of has a much more comprehensive approach?
So what's correctly motivating the administration is a concern about violence. And there has been an uptick in some cities around violence. That's absolutely right. It's not nearly as pervasive as they're making it out to be, but it's real. And in a lot of urban communities especially, we shouldn't be worried about an increase. We should be worried about the high levels of violence those communities have always had. And the fact about that, and it's real science now, is that that kind of violence is driven by a very, very small number of extreme people. There's often an association with drugs. So those sorts of folks are often in gangs and drug crews and that kind of thing. The violence itself is really not about the drug trade. The violence is overwhelmingly personal and beef and back and forth retaliation and that sort of thing. And those groups and the really at-risk people in them are pretty readily identifiable. And when communities and law enforcement and cities get together, identify those folks and focus on them in a very, very strategic way with the right kind of law enforcement, especially with reaching out to them and letting them know they're being watched and what their legal risks are, with community engagement and with the right kind of social services, cities can do a lot about violence.
So we're talking here about the Justice Department's new war on drugs on the Leslie Marshall Show. The number here is 1-888-653-7543 if you'd like to join the conversation. Michael Collins from the Drug Policy Alliance. There's been a re-emphasis or a new emphasis, if you will, on the different kinds of drugs that are out there now and different variations, synthetic drugs. What are synthetics? What is the new drugs or new forms of drugs like fentanyl that is really seeming to animate a lot of the heroin and other opioid epidemic issues that we have?
Yeah, so it's a good question. You know, fentanyl essentially is a very good example of a synthetic drug. And you know, historically, heroin has been produced in, you know, the fields of Afghanistan or Mexico and through opium and through a plant. Now what we're seeing is, you know, a rise in a number of labs in places like China and also in Mexico, where they produce essentially a synthetic alternative to heroin. It's a chemically altered drug. It is produced in a lab. And it's then added to heroin and brought into the country, and it makes the heroin far more potent. So drug sellers like that, drug users like that, the problem is that it's behind a lot of overdose deaths. You know, people are taking heroin with this fentanyl-laced heroin and therefore not realizing how potent it is and overdosing. And a lot of folks believe that, you know, fentanyl is behind the rise of the rise in overdose deaths in the country. And on top of that, you know, people are producing sort of alternatives to synthetic sort of chemically altered versions of fentanyl itself and making that even more powerful. And so it's just a real challenge from a drug policy point of view in terms of like how to stop overdose deaths.
So whenever you have those challenges, I think when, and you see the, you know, the number of people that are dying from this, Congress is starting to consider options of how they should do something, if anything, pass legislation. And are there things that are on the horizon that Congress is considering, and what are your views on that?
Yeah, I think policymakers and members of Congress are often, you know, very lazy when it comes to ideas around how to combat drugs. And what we see often is, you know, a new drug arrives in the scene. There's a lot of media hysteria around it. Congress and legislators across the country, even at the state level, are forced to act. And basically, they just dust off the old drug war playbook and increase sentences and enhance penalties. And we're sort of seeing that now develop in Congress. You know, Jeff Sessions is definitely a part of that. He's spoken about drugs like fentanyl and the danger. And we're seeing legislation introduced and potentially moving in Congress that would increase penalties for synthetic drugs like fentanyl, that would expand the penalties, that would give the Attorney General, in this case Jeff Sessions, broad authority to decide when a drug is scheduled and what penalties apply. And I think fundamentally there's a big problem with giving the Attorney General broad authority to decide which drugs are scheduled and which penalties apply. You know, really, there should be public health input, which is the traditional scheduling process. There should also be strong input from Congress. You know, Congress makes the law, law enforcement enforce the law. So I think like this is the wrong approach. And really, we've tried to move away from, you know, the incarceration only approach to drugs and move more towards public health and treatment. And so it's disappointing when these new drugs arrive in the scene and people just take out the old drug war playbook and use that.
We're talking with Michael Collins and David Kennedy on the issue of drugs and the epidemic that is happening around the country on opioids. And David, when we're talking about anything that deals with public safety, policing, drugs, criminal justice, the issue of race is always front and center because the impacted communities have historically been black and brown, but the current opioid crisis is affecting a much broader population. And so because this crisis is affecting white populations, both rural, suburban, middle class, is there going to be any kind of change in the way that the nation approaches this particular crisis compared to the one 20, 30 years ago?
Well, Michael's exactly right in noting that the drug war has not been driven ever by frontline law enforcement. It's been driven by politicians and the policies and legislation that they set. If you're close to frontline law enforcement, one of the really interesting things over the past 30 years or so is the way that those folks have learned that drug war kind of drug enforcement is pointless. Cops have been saying forever, we can't arrest our way out of this. And they're there at the coalface, and they know that's true. Leadership has gotten really smart about this. You hear police chiefs in big cities saying things like, I'm done chasing the kilo fairy, by which they mean they're not standing by any more tables full of drugs and guns and money, knowing that it makes no difference on the street. And they will say flat out that, you know, violence is a law enforcement issue, but drug addiction is a public health issue. And police are taking a lot of heat these days because they are, in fact, treating the opioid epidemic differently than they did the crack epidemic. And it's very easy to look at that and say, well, crack was in black neighborhoods, and so it was a prison problem, and opiates are in white neighborhoods, and so it's a public health problem. And there's some of that, but it's also not doing the cops enough credit because they have learned their lesson on this. And what you see them doing is making sure that their frontline officers have the opiate antagonists so that they can save people in overdoses. They're thinking about things like safe injection sites. They're thinking about moving treatment directly into jail and diversion. They're really not in a drug war frame of mind.
So when you're working with these police departments. What are the other types of things that they're doing in addition to diversion that is really looking to approach public safety in a different kind of way?
Well, the better folks in policing have become really focused on what they and the academics call legitimacy. And it's a simple but absolutely fundamental idea, which is that you cannot police a community effectively if they don't trust you and think that your heart and mind are in the right place. And one of the horrible consequences of the drug war and things like zero tolerance policing was that it demonized whole neighborhoods. There was a virtue for a lot of years of thinking that we should do as much draconian enforcement as we possibly can. Stop and frisk and zero tolerance basically said these entire neighborhoods are potentially felonious and we're going to treat them that way. It alienated those neighborhoods. It saturated them with men with criminal records whose lives will never be right. And police have learned that you can't do anything more than occupy a neighborhood like that. You can never work with it. They will never trust you. They won't give you information. They won't respect you. They won't respect the law. And to kind of go back to a couple of points we've hit already, good cops don't want to do that kind of work anymore. They have learned that the neighborhood is not dangerous. There's a small number of high-risk people in it. And they're really trying to focus as much as possible on those high-risk folks, and with them often not only through enforcement, and do as little unintended harm to the rest of the community as they can manage. And some of them are even talking really frankly about race and reconciliation and the history of the police and in the original racial sin of the nation and slavery and all that kind of thing. The good people are in a pretty remarkable place.
So we have a call on line two, Dean from Buffalo. Dean, you're on with the Leslie Marshall Show.
All right. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that all police officers should have to wear body cameras, because if you're wearing a body camera, you're showing the department or the powers that be everything that's going on. I mean, you can't hide in plain sight, as it were. And that really helps with accountability. Also, they need to deregulize non-serious drugs like marijuana, because marijuana really doesn't, or from what I've heard, doesn't really do anything to you. It's a high-end narcotic to do.
Yeah, Dean, thanks for the call. Michael, on the second part of that question in terms of marijuana, your thoughts on what society should do with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. I mean, I think we talked about what's changed over the last, like, 20, 30 years in the U.S. You know, one has been, you know, a loosening of drug laws, especially as it relates to marijuana. You now have 8 states plus Washington, D.C. voting to legalize marijuana. You have over, I think it's like 30 states now that have medical marijuana. And I think, you know, what we've seen there is, you know, with marijuana legalization, like, the sky hasn't fallen. You know, life goes on. And look, there are definitely challenges around marijuana legalization, especially in the public health realm. But, you know, from a criminal justice point of view, it's definitely a step in the right direction. The number of law enforcement that, you know, start off interactions with individuals as a result of, you know, the smell of marijuana or possession of marijuana, stop and frisk, those kind of policies have been very much linked with marijuana prohibition. So the legalization of marijuana is definitely a step in the right direction.
And I would really want to get into this whole conversation of body-worn cameras and, well, how police should utilize them, but I think we're running up out of time. My thanks to Michael Collins from the Drug Policy Alliance and David Kennedy from the National Network for Safe Communities at John Jay College. Thanks to both of you for being on, and we will be right back. This is the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your guest host for today, Ed Chung. And welcome back. This is the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm Ed Chung, and we have joining us now Patrick Gavin. Patrick, healthcare all the time. We have some news about Senator Heller.
That's right. The Nevada Republican just announced that he would not support the Republican healthcare bill. in its current form, which I believe brings the number to 5 Republican senators who have come out against it. The question going forward, especially as we head into next week, is whether or not that number gets bigger or smaller. There's some indication that, you know, more than likely at least a couple of folks will, I think, in fact, end up supporting the bill as long as there's little tweaks made here and there. I think Rand Paul is probably permanently against it. Dean Heller was centered pretty staunchly against it as well, but said that he would be open to changes. So the real question is going to be whether or not these 4 or 5 senators actually represent a larger constituency within the Republican Party in the Senate, or if, in fact, they can be slowly picked off one by one by Mitch McConnell in order to ensure passage.
So in other news, progressives had a bitter defeat in Georgia in a congressional race, but there are other races that are coming up, especially for governor. There's a big one right close to here, which is in Virginia. Some word about some high-profile people looking to jump into that race, into campaign?
That's right. Barack Obama is going to make his first political return to electoral politics by campaigning on behalf of the Democratic candidate in that race, Ralph Northam. I think partially this is part of Obama's effort to try to stem some of the bleeding that Democrats have seen in recent elections.
Great. Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate that update. Just so for everybody who's listening, we want to just reemphasize how important it is for you to get engaged into this healthcare bill process. The Senate is really the last stop here, the last bulwark. And if the Senate passes this, it is going to become law. Again, just the devastation that we're talking about from this health care bill, where you have in the House bill, which was better in some ways, if you will, and I don't want to characterize that and use that characterization in any other kind of, in any other context, but this horrible bill will put 20-some million people without insurance. We have a CBO score that's coming out next week. There is some concern that there were tweaks into this Senate bill that is trying to make the score look a little bit better, but Don't be fooled by that. This is going to affect a lot of people in a really bad way. And so for those of you who want to get more information on this, just make sure that we're talking, that you know the information. There's a Trump Care Toolkit if you want to get some more information, and you can find that at www.trumpcaretoolkit.com. .org. So make sure that you get involved and that you know about what's in this bill. It's going to be take some effort, but really, really important. And just to leave you off with a few words, remember, President Trump said these bills are mean, 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 and we'll take him at his word for that. This is the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm Ed Chung sitting in today. It's been real fun. So we hope to hear you soon next time, and tune in next week again for the Leslie Marshall Show.